Olympic Committee has banned foreign and domestic spectators for the first time in the history of the Olympic Games. Meanwhile, athletes, support staff, and media are subject to strict COVID-19 protocols. Most world leaders decided not to participate in the event. Also, top sponsors have stayed away, highlighting strong opposition to holding the event in COVID-fatigued Japan. Tokyo is battling a surge in coronavirus infections and is under emergency measures. Daily cases in Tokyo are currently at their highest in 6 months. The Japanese capital logged nearly 2,000 new daily infections before the official opening ceremony. Japanese officials have vowed to hold safe and secure games despite the lingering pandemic. However, a largely unvaccinated Japanese public is worried that the global gathering of 11,000 athletes could trigger a super spreader event. Earlier this week, the chief of the Tokyo 2020 Organizing Committee said they are not ruling out canceling the games as more athletes pulled out after testing positive for COVID-19. So far, over 100 people linked to the games have tested positive for the virus. A survey by the Asahi Shimbun newspaper says around 70% of Japanese people believe that Olympic organizers are not able to contain coronavirus infections. For weeks, there have been calls for the already postponed games to be cancelled amid the rise of COVID-19 cases in Tokyo and elsewhere across the world. Hundreds of people gathered outside Tokyo's National Stadium ahead of the Olympic opening ceremony, while others demonstrated near the Tokyo government building to demand the cancellation of the event. However, the International Olympic Committee has rejected the idea of calling off the event. The committee could lose billions of dollars in broadcast rights if the games were cancelled. That could be a blatant example of choosing money over people's lives.
Every day, Inas gets on this boat with her younger siblings to help their family with herding their water buffaloes. To them, it's an everyday hobby to play with what they call black monsters, a hobby that is about to turn to ashes. Their bulky playmates are now dying of thirst in an unprecedented drought that has devastated the buffalo's habitat.
Every day we lose two or three of our buffaloes and sheep because there is no water, and this water over there is sour and polluted and is toxic to the animals.
This has been the case for thousands of residents in Iran's province of Khuzestan, who have for the past days been protesting over what they call mismanagement of water resources. Khuzestan is inhabited predominantly by Iranian Arab tribes who live on agriculture and animal farming, which have now been devastated by the worst drought in half a century. Heads of tribes have over the past days been acting as mediators between the protesters and authorities, asking the demonstrators to calm down while urging officials to solve the problems.
We lost our farms and livestock in the drought. We need our rivers and marshlands to be filled with water for our businesses to be up and running again.
Every day the scale of the disaster grows and we are paying the price. Our demand is legitimate. The authorities need to do something before an irreversible catastrophe takes place.
On Friday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, stepped in and called on authorities to speed up their efforts to tackle the crisis.
استعدادهای طبیعی که در این استان وجود داره با این همه کارخانجاتی که در این استان وجود داره وضع مردم به جایی برسه که اونها رو ناراضی کنه و ناراحت کنه اونها رو مسئله آبشون مسئله فاضلابشون.
Over the past week, delegations from the government and other entities have been visiting the affected areas to review the situation. In one of its latest measures, the government opened the valves of Karkhe and Dez dams, which have partly filled the riverbeds.
Water is starting to trickle into the riverbeds, raising hopes that life will once again return to the dried land. However, residents here say the crisis is far from over, and authorities need to find a permanent solution to the issue. Yusuf Jalali from the outskirts of Bostan, in the province of Khuzestan.
I'm Mark Wadsworth. You might have heard.
Mark Wadsworth is a lifelong anti-racist who came to prominence during the brutal racist murder of black teenager Stephen Lawrence in 1993. Mark supported Stephen's parents in their long fight for justice and even introduced them to anti-apartheid revolutionary figures Bishop Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela. Yet despite Wadsworth's anti-racial credentials, even he was not spared from the anti-Semitism witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn's allies and pro-Palestinian activists in the Labour Party.
I couldn't believe that somebody, you know, groups of people would try to fabricate him or character assassinate him with all his contributions.
Mark has done so much for the black community, and he has the black community backing him all the way, and to see such libelous statements being made about him it's very disappointing.
Mark Wadsworth was one of many left-wing pro-Palestinian activists expelled from the Labour Party during Jeremy Corbyn's leadership following an unfounded accusation of anti-Semitism. Since then, he's been smeared by a host of British tabloids, including the Jewish Chronicle, who today have been obliged to apologise in open court as well as pay substantial damages.
The Jewish Chronicle also published an apology to Mark back in May for an article published in March that accused him of conspiracy to, quote, intimidate, threaten or harass Jewish activists. Accusations that they have now admitted were wholly false.
I'm elated. I've been vindicated. I've suffered 5 years of smear, trial by media. In fact, with the Jewish Chronicle, I managed to get them to change 15 stories. Over a period of less than 5 years, they have had almost 50 articles naming me in a negative way, which is like a vendetta. And I just decided this has got to stop. It's the Labour Party that has done this to me, because by kicking me out on totally false grounds, huge miscarriage of justice, in April 2018, they made it open season.
The judge in the British High Court described accuracy and truth as fundamental tenets of journalism and explained that the allegations made by the Jewish Chronicle with regards to Mark Wadsworth fell short of both. The lies told by the Chronicle were one of many by British tabloid press, but Wadsworth hopes his legal victory will act as a deterrent for those that seek to smear him in the future. Ahmed Cabello, London.
In the limelight.
With only about half of Americans vaccinated, Dr. Anthony Fauci and other current and former health officials vigorously pressed the case on Sunday, 25th of July, that inoculations were the best way to stem a tide of new COVID cases. Dr. Anthony S. Fauci warned on Sunday, 25th of July, that the coronavirus pandemic is now going in the wrong direction in the United States because too many Americans are still choosing not to get vaccinated. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Pam Bellock, Azzy Pabera, Daniel Slotnick, and Jesus Jimenez. The piece is titled, It's Not Going to Be Good. Fauci sounds alarm over low vaccination rates fueling COVID surge. Please stay with us for more. Only about half of Americans vaccinated, Dr. Anthony Fauci and other current and former health officials vigorously pressed the case on Sunday, 25th of July, that inoculations were the best way to stem a tide of new COVID cases. Dr. Anthony Fauci warned on Sunday that the coronavirus pandemic is now going in the wrong direction in the United States because too many Americans are still choosing not to get vaccinated. Asked on CNN's State of the Union program, about projections in recent statistical models that COVID-19 cases and deaths could surge in the coming months if vaccination rates don't increase, Dr. Fauci said it's not going to be good. With about half of Americans not yet vaccinated and the fast-spreading Delta variant of the coronavirus circulating, Dr. Fauci and a range of current and former health officials expressed exasperation at the situation on Sunday and vigorously pressed the case that vaccination is the best and most effective way to stem the tide of COVID cases. It is really a pandemic among the unvaccinated, Dr. Fauci said, adding, it's like you have two kinds of America. You have the very vulnerable unvaccinated part, and you have the really relatively protected vaccinated part. If you're vaccinated, you are in a very different category than someone who is not vaccinated. The situation is so dire that in recent days, even some Republican governors in low vaccination states have been pointedly exhorting people to get a COVID vaccine. On Sunday, 25th of July, on CNN, Governor Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas said, with the new school year on the horizon, this is a pivotal moment in our race against the COVID virus, adding that what's holding us back is a low vaccination rate. Governor Asa Hutchinson of Arkansas, a Republican, said he has been holding town hall recently, which he credited for a 40% increase in vaccination. Still, he added that certainly the resistance has hardened among some people. It's simply false information, he said. It's a myth. On CBS's Face the Nation, Dr. Jerome Adams, who was Surgeon General in the Trump administration, also encouraged vaccination, casting the decision in patriotic terms. Get vaccinated because it's going to help every single American enjoy the freedoms that we want to return to, he said. Dr. Jerome Adams said some people still have legitimate questions about getting vaccinated, including workers who worry post-vaccine side effects might cause them to miss a day's work or a paycheck. He predicted immunization rates would increase once the vaccines, currently available under emergency use authorization from the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, become fully licensed. That will likely prompt the military and some businesses to mandate vaccination for service members and employees, he said. In the meantime, Dr. Jerome Adams said the message should be, it is your choice, but choices come with consequences to you and to others, including children not yet old enough for vaccination and people who are medically vulnerable. Several current and former officials discussed whether recommendations or mandates for wearing face masks should be reinstated. Dr. Anthony Fauci said the Biden administration is considering reissuing stronger mask-wearing guidelines. In May, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention relaxed its guideline, saying that people who are fully vaccinated do not need to wear a face mask in most indoor settings. Dr. Jerome Adams said that guidance, quite frankly, has confused citizens. It's frustrated businesses and public health officials who I continue to hear from, and it's been, by any qualification, a failure. He said the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, should state clearly that even people who are vaccinated should wear face masks if they're in public, around people whose vaccination status is unclear, or in a community where COVID cases are increasing. The Center for Disease Control, the CDC, needs to give those businesses, those health officials, a little bit of cover by clarifying the guidance that they have out there, Dr. Jerome Adams said. Meanwhile, as a Delta variant of the coronavirus spreads through unvaccinated populations in the United States, many municipalities, colleges, and businesses are weighing not only whether to require vaccinations, but also whether to reimpose wearing of face masks indoors. Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, said on Thursday, 22nd of July, that her agency had no plans to change the guidance it issued back in May. That guidance allowed localities leeway to make their own rules, but said that people who were fully vaccinated could shed their face masks in most situations. Many Americans, vaccinated or not, did so with relief. Now, the highly contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus and the fear of breakthrough infections, however mild they usually are, have led many individuals to consider covering their faces again. Nationally, new cases, hospitalizations, and deaths remain far below their winter peaks, but there have been steep rises in both cases and hospitalizations in some less vaccinated areas. Vaccines are effective against the worst outcomes of COVID-19, including cases caused by the Delta variant of the coronavirus. But the pace of inoculations has decreased more than 80% since mid-April, and less than half of the population of the United States is fully vaccinated, according to federal data. As a result, some cities are turning to wearing face masks as an additional precaution. Los Angeles County in California, one of the first places to reinstate a mask mandate, requires face masks to be worn in public indoor spaces, regardless of vaccination status. Also in St. Louis, Missouri, announced a similar mask mandate on Friday, 23rd of July.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Spotlight.
Tunisia is facing its worst crisis in a decade after President Kais Saied ousted the government and suspended parliament with the help of the army. Now, this was a move denounced as a coup by the main parties. Was the move by the president constitutional? Why would the president make such a move if he knew it would throw the country into a crisis? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at where Tunisia is headed and whether the crisis is an economic crisis exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic.
Clashes have erupted between supporters of Tunisian President Kais Saied and proponents of the ruling Ennahda party outside the parliament amid a months-long political crisis in the African nation. The rival rallies took place after Parliament Speaker Rashid Ghannouchi urged people to take to the streets. This followed Saied's Sunday decision to invoke the Constitution to dismiss Prime Minister Hesham Mashishi and freeze the Parliament for 30 days. The President, however, said the 30-day period could be extended if needed and that he would govern alongside a new Premier. Ghannouchi condemned the move as a coup.
Today we are surprised by supreme decisions that not only surprise Ennahda, but also surprise the Tunisian people and the world in a country that is proud of being the first Arab democracy and having the latest constitution, announcing decisions that are essentially a coup d'etat, and it's called nothing but a coup.
Ghannouchi also led a sit-in protest in front of the parliament after the army blocked him from entering the legislature building following the president's order. There were mixed reactions in Tunisia to Said's decision.
Regarding this decision, it's the first time in my life I have heard a head of a state take a correct decision. We have taken back our country. This is the first time I have gone out to the streets to celebrate.
The decisions by President Kais Saied are not correct, against the constitution and the reality. They bring us back again to 1954. The scene of the parliament closed by tanks is very disgraceful.
The president and the Assembly of the Representatives of the People of Tunisia were elected in separate popular votes in 2019, while Mishishi took office last year. His fragile government lurched from crisis to crisis as it struggled to deal with the coronavirus pandemic and the need for urgent reforms amid its political disputes with Said. Said's move to dismiss the government and freeze parliament followed mass demonstrations in several Tunisian cities earlier on Sunday. The protesters demanded the government's removal amid a weeks-long spike in COVID cases and the devastating impact of the pandemic on the country's already ailing economy. However, the president's decision has posed the greatest challenge to the country since its 2011 revolution, which ousted longtime ruler Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. Over the past decade, the country has faced a series of challenges, such as terrorism, which has choked the country's vital tourism sector and contributed to an economic decline.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the debate, of the spotlight, that is. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan joins us from London, Ontario. And we also have journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas, who joins us from London. All right, let me first turn to you, Said Mohsen Abbas, and ask you what basically has happened here. I mean, obviously this was not a spontaneous, I'm guessing, decision to have been made by the president. I mean, what did he do? Because this is kind of like a complete gutting of the country's main institutions, except for the military, of course.
Well, as we know, Tunisia has had nine governments since the 2011 revolution. It's hardly been stable, but it is famed for being the only democracy to emerge from the Arab Spring, the so-called Arab Spring. On the other hand, what we've seen is the usual corruption, poverty, unemployment, the very things which were supposed to have launched off the Arab Spring in Tunisia. Of course, that was the starting point with the immolation of a young man at that time, Mohamed Bouazi, I believe his name was, but nothing has changed. Situation has got worse over the last year. Undoubtedly, COVID-19 has infected many Tunisians and severely damaged the economy, which is heavily dependent on Europe, to be honest. Its real GDP in that time contracted between 8.8% in 2020 after growing about 1% the year before. But due to the general decline in the economic activity and the hardening of financing conditions, it really created more and more inflation, more problems. So in all areas of the economy, production, for instance, fell in all sectors except agriculture and fishing, and generally a huge decline. This coupled with, of course, unemployment figures of around 17.5%, and rising, have put a huge pressure on the public. So the public genuinely is upset with the government in place. The government itself is a kind of a mixture of the largest party, the Al-Nahda party, which is a Muslim Brotherhood offshoot, which has arguably performed pretty badly. But the president at the core of this is an individual who wasn't necessarily linked to any parties before. He was just part of a constitutional process, and he actually put together the constitution that Tunisia ran on after 2011, but gradually it seems that he's, as an independent person with good links with the army and the security services in general, he's managed to get into a situation now where he can quite clearly tell these parties what to do. But the result has been a little chaotic, to say the least. So that's the backdrop. What we're seeing, of course, rolling out, we can discuss as we go along in the program.
Well, Edward Corrigan, I mean, if we take the Mohsen Abbas in terms of the economic angle to this story, which has been reflected across the media as being one of the reasons, perhaps, for the country to go through the problems that it has and then perhaps to show itself I'm guessing, I mean, I'm no analyst, but I'm guessing that this is not the way to go for the president to come out to oust the government, to suspend parliament with the help of the army, and also is planning to replace the defense ministers and the justice ministers. I don't think that's going to help the economy of a country, because we're seeing what the results are. I'm trying to get to the thinking that's gone on here of the president and what exactly is going on with his approach here.
Well, Tunisia has been in an economic and political crisis since at least 2019, and arguably much before that. You have, as the earlier speaker, you know, I think very correctly indicated, there's, you know, the economy's in a tailspin. They have a lot of problems with regard to the oil industry. The IMF and other financial institutions are putting the screws to Tunisia. And the tourism industry has been severely affected because ISIS has launched several terrorist attacks, which has scared away all the tourists. And that's sort of like another blow to the economy that they really can't afford. The younger generation is very angry. They're unemployed. They can't get jobs. Promises are made, but they're not kept. And of course, you've got the COVID crisis on top of this. You know, there's over 18,600 deaths. There's a fourth wave, and they have a shortage of vaccinations. But the Russians and the Chinese are stepping forward and sending, vaccines to Tunisia. But this is, I think that the president is an individual. He doesn't have a power base in the political parties in the country. And he does have, obviously, some ties to the military and security forces. But one commentator in the United States, who's supposedly an expert, said that the president has no power, he's got no ability, no plan, and he is just fires people, you know, which is kind of like Donald Trump's approach towards politics. It doesn't solve the problems. The Al-Huda Islamic Party is the largest party in the country. It is 64 seats, and it's been part of the government, but, you know, to take the largest party and prevent them from, you know, going to the parliament and exercising their lawful authority is very, very dangerous. But there is a split in Tunisia between sort of a more secular approach and then a more Islamic approach. So the Islamic parties are strong, and they are, you know, at a very serious conflict between the two visions of how, you know, Tunisia should be run. And of course, Tunisia was the first of the Arab Spring revolutions, and there was a great deal of hope for it because it did get rid of an autocratic leader, Ben Ali, and it was hopeful, but it hasn't delivered on the promise. And that is now the frustration has come out. There's been, you know, mass demonstrations, you know, in support of the president, but also in support of the parliament, which has been dismissed. So it's very, very unstable, very dangerous. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there's no real solution to this. They have a 30-day window which to try to solve these problems. But unless there's a lot of goodwill from the president, from the prime minister, from the largest political party, and the speaker of this lower house, these people need to come together. And I don't see anything coming forward. And it looks like it's just an economic and political and, you know, secular religious mess.
Okay. Well, mess indeed is what it looks like, at least for now. Say, Mohsen Abbas, let's get down to the support factor here. Based on what is reported, the president is backed by the army, and it is said that he's actually an outsider. Tell us if you think that's true. And then, based on what has happened, the groups within that country are saying that this step is undemocratic. Some are saying that it's unconstitutional, and that includes the Ennahda. And in terms of, for example, the unconstitutional part of this whole thing, there is an Article 80 which I guess in his eyes was going to give him the power to do what he did. But it says that it requires consultation with the Prime Minister and the Parliament Speaker. Now, Ghannouchi, who was the Parliament Speaker, said that that did not happen. But who has the popular support here in terms of the groups, in terms of the president, and then in terms of the Tunisians themselves?
I think this is what makes this situation very volatile and very dangerous, because the president came into office with something like 70% of the vote. So he was clearly a popular president, and therefore he does have backing within the people of Tunisia. The people of Tunisia did overwhelmingly dislike the way that the Prime Minister Saïd has been running the affairs, of course. So this means that there is genuine discontent, and I think it's it is the case that the president has that general sense that he's different from all the others, and he might carry some hope for those people who are fed up with the existing power bases, as you were. So that's his legitimacy. He does have some street power. I think he does certainly have the army's confidence, and it may well be that the army is pushing this more and more. But I don't see it as he would have described it, because using Article 80, being a professor of the constitutional itself, or a constitutional professor, law professor rather, he cited extraordinary measures to deal with what is thought of as an imminent threat to the country. Now, the imminent threat that he was indicating was this kind of failure to deal with the coronavirus. And then, too, he has a point, because the shortage of supplies, and only 7% of the population out of 11.7 million people have been fully vaccinated. So clearly a large number of people haven't had the vaccine. The coronavirus itself reached a record of about 324 hours of a period recently. And, it's got the highest per capita death rate, or one of the highest per capita death rates in the world, perhaps even the highest, I'm not sure exactly, but it certainly is amongst the top in that respect. So there were huge problems around the coronavirus issue, without a doubt. But going more widely, I don't think it's a really sincere effort that he's made to prevent that imminent threat that he's put forward. But nor is it a well-planned coup to take power in the traditional sense of a coup. I mean, he's not fully tried to dispose of the parties yet. He hasn't used the army to slam down all the institutions. In fact, the Interior Ministry didn't listen to him when he gave certain orders straight after the takeover, if you like. And he was defied. He put in his own presidential guard as the head of the Interior Ministry subsequently. And he's relying on that street support and the army to clumsily move forward. It's a poorly thought out, clumsy political ploy from what I can see. The other interesting thing is that the Egyptians, the United Arab Emirates, and the Saudis are all against him. They're hailing, they're hailing this as a victory against the Muslim Brotherhood. Traditionally, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't curry have the favor of the Saudis, etc. So there are interesting geopolitical plays that are going on here as well. He could, in the next instant, put the parliamentarians and the prime minister under house arrest. That could be an avenue he takes if the likes of Mr. Ghannouchi, the head of the Al-Nahda party, etc., Dr. Saïd don't listen to him. And that creates the volatility on the streets. It would mean perhaps those parties would mobilize on the streets, and even more violence and even more trouble could ensue. It really, there are solutions which might entail outsiders who have influence, certainly Europeans have influence, getting involved in negotiating some sort of peace here.
Okay, well, Edward Corrigan, if we talk about outside influence, tell us what you think, whether it's in the form of the UAE and Saudi Arabia, who do not like the Muslim Brotherhood. In the case of Ennahda, that would apply in some respects. And then you also have the European Union, perhaps, in the form of maybe France coming into the picture, or maybe just as a whole, trying to see how it could influence the events that are unfolding there. Do you see any of these happening?
Well, they're all happening. That's the problem. The Saudis have a very, Islamic approach towards politics and to support their own dictatorship and authoritarian rule. Same with the United Arab Emirates, but they have they see the Muslim Brotherhood and any sort of Islamic party as a threat to their control, even though they use a lot of the same symbolism and points to support their own regimes. But I think that the president is really stretching the argument. You know, Article 80 of the Constitution, it says it allows him to take exceptional measures in an imminent danger, and it has to be in consultation with the parliament and the prime minister. And these consultations haven't taken place. And, you know, COVID is a serious problem, but I don't think it's an imminent danger that would really justify exceptional measures. So I think, you know, Kais Saied is pushing the argument and trying to maybe deflect the economic and political problems and focusing on COVID, which a lot of it is not really the fault of, you know, they haven't solved the problem, but I don't think you can blame the prime minister or the parliament for that because they just didn't have the vaccine. So there may be pressure from, you know, Western powers in controlling the COVID vaccines and not giving them to Tunisia. And that's a way of putting pressure on the government and to help, you know, I guess, cause problems and disturbances which other countries can take advantage of. You know, Egypt is, you know, does not like the Muslim Brotherhood, but the Islamic party, Al-Nuda party is the strongest party in the country. And, you know, they have, you know, obviously got a lot of political support. They're organized. But there is this, you know, the younger generation doesn't accept their views and, you know, wants a more secular approach towards politics. So this, it's really, you know, badly divided. And, you know, I don't see any real solution coming here. They're going to need a lot of money from somewhere. And unless the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates and other, you know, people with deep pockets will step up to the plate and help the government. But France, of course, was the former colonial power in Tunisia. And, you know, they are having their own problems right now with a very anti-Islamic movement where they have banned the hijab. And they have, there's a lot of problems in France. So I don't see the French and Macron going to be supporting, you know, Islamic democracy in Tunisia. So it's a mess, and there's no solution. It's easy to say that there's no solution, but there isn't a solution. And the president was actually, he wrote the Constitution. So he's a constitutional law professor, and it gave him, you know, there's a lot of hope to that. And I guess that helped him with his, winning the election. But he doesn't have, you know, a political power base that is rooted in political parties or, you know, sort of mass support, even though there is obviously some support. And a lot of people were happy to see the prime minister removed and also the parliament suspended. And actually all 64 lawmakers from the Al-Huda Islamic Party are ordered not to leave the country. So it's not quite house arrest, but they are being restricted. So anyways, it's a mess, and there's no, you know, solution on before us right now.
Sure. Okay. Well, let's go with the line, Seymour Sin Abbas, that you said, I believe that you said that this situation, some degree, maybe to a large degree, if I understood you correctly, is a result of the poor economic performance of the country that's been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. I mean, after all, you had an 8% GDP drop for the last year, and the situation has not been steady in any shape or form since the uprising. Up to this point, there hasn't been really great economic factors coming out of the country. And this makes it fertile land for terrorists to obviously penetrate into the ones who are out of jobs, etc. We know that's how Daesh terrorists and Al-Qaeda spread their wings. Do you think that this is something that this road is the road that Tunisia is going to be going down on, given the fact that you have Tunisia that's marred by terrorists in one of those areas anyways?
You certainly can't rule it out. You only have to look at Libya next door, virtually, and see what's gone on there. And the situation that's emerged there with Haftar and with all the kind of shenanigans that have gone on, ISIS have been involved. You've got all sorts of abilities of mercenary forces. Turkey got involved in Libya. The French were involved. The UAE and Egypt and Saudi Arabia, again, are involved there. So clearly all of these foreign powers do have interests. And we all know that ISIS is actually a mercenary tool for, Western forces, and quite often is used as a way of either creating chaos or getting certain folk to relinquish power. It's going to be interesting to see how it pans out. Certainly, you know, nobody wants another refugee sort of crisis with, of course, enough refugees passing through Libya into Europe. Europe certainly doesn't want another exodus via Tunisia. So they've got a lot of interest in trying to keep stability here in Tunisia. They've got, of course, the rise of the Islamic State, which happened because of the Arab Spring, which is also on their plate. And those forces are wandering around in the places like Tunisia looking for opportunities, and whoever's backing them might decide it's time to have a piece of action there as well. But the only hope is really, I think the Europeans probably stand the best chance with their established roots and links in trying to renew a national dialogue. They did this in 2014 with some success, and to try and draw a roadmap out of the current sort of constitutional crisis, and perhaps to get special committees to take charge of the COVID response and actually get the vaccines to Tunisia, make it an emergency case, if you like. They could also certainly get involved in securing economic support. The Europeans could put forward an economic plan, but that would mean the increased neoliberalization and the control of Tunisia by the World Bank, by those same old institutions. And who knows, for some of us who are real cynics, it could even be that this is exactly what's required. Perhaps, the Ennahda party wasn't quite being able to do what the powers that be wanted them, and this might be a way of shaking them up to try and threaten them and to actually sort of perhaps even take over through a dictatorial means. It wouldn't be the first time. They did it in Egypt with Sisi. Libya has the same sort of scenario, and of course Tunisia could be another along the lines. I don't think it'll get to that, but certainly at the moment it looks awfully dangerous and awfully volatile, and as my colleague said, it's very hard to see a way out immediately without some major money power being involved to persuade parties to go the direction of peace.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank our guest, international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan. Many thanks. And journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas there from London. From Miko Etap, my entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
The Limelight.
Carbon dioxide emissions are forecast to jump this year by the second biggest annual rise in history, as global economies pour stimulus cash into fossil fuels in the recovery from the COVID-19 recession. The leap will be second only to the massive rebound 10 years ago after the financial crisis, and will put climate hopes out of reach unless governments act quickly, the International Energy Agency, IEA, has warned. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled "Carbon Emissions to Soar in 2021 by Second Highest Rate in History." Carbon dioxide emissions are forecast to jump this year by the second biggest annual rise in history, as global economies pour stimulus cash into fossil fuels in the recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic and recession. The leap will be the second only to the massive rebound 10 years ago after the financial crisis, and will put climate hopes out of reach unless governments act quickly, the International Energy Agency has warned. surging use of coal, the dirtiest fossil fuel for electricity, is largely driving the emissions rise, especially across Asia, but also in the United States. Coal's rebound causes particular concern because it comes despite plunging prices for renewable energy, which is now cheaper than coal. Speaking in an interview with The Guardian, Fatih Birol, the executive director of the International Energy Agency and one of the world's leading authorities on energy and climate, said, "This is shocking and very disturbing. On the one hand, governments today are saying climate change is their priority, but on the other hand, we're seeing the second biggest emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, rise in history. It is really disappointing." Carbon dioxide emissions need to be cut by 45% this decade if the world is to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, scientists have warned. That means the 2020s must be the decade when the world changes course before the level of carbon in the atmosphere rises too high to avoid dangerous levels of heating. But the scale of the current emissions rebound from the COVID-19 crisis means our starting point is definitely not a good one, said Fatih Birol. Birol compared the current surge of carbon dioxide emissions to the financial crisis, when emissions rose by more than 6% in 2010 after countries tried to stimulate their economies through cheap fossil fuel energy. "It seems we are back on course to repeat the same mistakes," he warned. "I am more disappointed this time round than in 2010. Carbon dioxide emissions plunged by a record 7% globally last year, owing to the lockdowns that followed the COVID-19 pandemic. But by the end of the year, they were already rebounding and on track to exceed 2019 levels in some areas. The International Energy Agency projections for 2021 show carbon dioxide emissions are likely to end this year still down slightly on 2019 levels, but on a rising path. Next year, there could be even stronger rises as air travel returns, Fatih Birol added. Aviation would normally contribute more than 2% of global emissions, but has been almost absent this past year. He called on governments to bring forward new climate policies urgently and seek a green recovery from the COVID-19 crisis. "Last year, I expressed my hope that the economic recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic should be green and sustainable. But these numbers indicate that this recovery is currently anything but sustainable for our climate," he said. The US President Joe Biden is convening a climate summit this week, with the leaders of 40 countries expected to attend, at which Biden will urge countries to come forward with strong commitments on cutting carbon dioxide emissions this decade. Fatih Birol said this was an opportunity for countries to change course and put policies in place for a green recovery. Birol added, "If governments take clear and imminent action, with the amount of cheap, clean energy technologies we have, we can transform this disappointment to some good outcomes." The International Energy Agency, IEA, is considered the global gold standard for energy data, and its projections for 2021 are based on comprehensive soundings from around the world, including data from existing energy sources and new plants scheduled to come on stream. Energy data from the end of last year showed fossil fuels ahead of 2019 levels, and the surge has continued in the first part of this year. Minutes Global Energy Review, published on Tuesday, 20th of April, the International Energy Agency found that global carbon emissions from energy use, which accounts for the great majority of greenhouse gas emissions, were on course to rise by 1.5 billion tons in 2021, after having fallen last year. That represents a 5% rise to 33 billion tons of carbon dioxide for the year. After more than half a decade of decline, global coal demand is forecast to grow by 4.5%, approaching its all-time peak in 2014. China is planning to build scores of coal-fired power stations, despite pledging last year to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2060. The country's five-year economic plan, set out by Beijing last month, contained little detail on curbing carbon emissions before 2030. However, after a surprise visit to Shanghai by the U.S. climate envoy John Kerry, the United States and China pledge cooperation on greenhouse gas emissions over the next decade. Coal use is also surging in the United States, reversing annual decline since 2013. Fatih Birol said this was the result of high gas prices, which are driving a switch from gas to coal for electricity generation. Former U.S. President Donald Trump scrapped regulations put in place by his predecessor Barack Obama to curb coal use by power stations. Joe Biden is considering further measures to hasten the move to renewable energy. Nicholas Stern, a climate economist and the chair of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change at the London School of Economics, said the International Energy Agency findings show that countries really must act with greater urgency to accelerate the transition to zero carbon pathways if we are to have a chance of emissions being reduced in line with the Paris Climate Accord. This is a crucial and historic opportunity to build back differently from the polluting ways of the past, and in particular, to move much more quickly away from coal. A strong and sustainable economic recovery will come from less coal and not more.